Welcome to the Salem Emerging Leaders Podcast, presented by the Salem Area Chamber of Commerce. Here are your hosts, Jacob Espinoza and Zachary Zalicki.
We have a very fun episode for you today. You get to meet our marketing and communications manager, Dan Johnson. Awesome guy. We're so excited to have him on the team. But we also break down the importance of local politics with Zach Zalicki. So stay tuned. Share with five friends. We appreciate you being here.
We are back at the Salem Emerging Leader Podcast.
That's top five.
Top five.
That's man. Top five.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Here's a new remix each time.
So we have Dan Johnson on, who's our new communications. What's your official title?
Marketing and communications manager.
So a big part of this job is going to be compiling my introduction songs. We need to do like a top of greatest hits episode.
I think we can do that.
That's a good idea.
So if you could get on that ASAP.
I'll add that to the list.
We need to get one of those boards too, so we can add some
sound
auto-tunes
effects,
and some sound effects.
Yeah.
Yeah, like an explosion in the background might be cool.
Yeah. The thing that always amazes me about this position is if you look at the job description, it's like every skill. You have to be good at everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot to live up to. So it's exciting though, and I'm happy to be part of the team and look forward to working with you guys more and more. So.
I know. I'm super excited that you're on the team. The interviews, you had some tough competition, some super tough competition.
Yeah.
But you definitely stood out. Talk a little bit about what you did before you came here, and what intrigued you about this job.
Yeah, so I went to school at U of O School of Journalism. Go Ducks!
Go Ducks! Three alum on this podcast right now. Yeah.
So yeah, super excited about that as well. When I learned that, but yeah, I always wanted to get into journalism. You know, at the time, and even still to today. Print journalism is really in a tough spot. So I decided to kind of transition to communications work and did that in 2014. I joined Willamette University as its communications person for alumni and parents. And so I was in that role for a few years, got promoted to more of a managerial role and was able to hire a full-time staff person and some students. And so all told, I was there for 8 years up until just this last December. And yeah, when I saw this role, it just really spoke to me, the storytelling aspect of it, the fact that it's really about the Salem business community. You know, I'm a Salem native. I've been here my whole life. And so I'm already invested in this community. And so it was just an opportunity to make an impact. And so that was something that I was really excited about. And also, you know, doing more content-driven type work instead of sort of managing.
You did freelance work too, right? For like a movie critic?
Yeah. So I had a fun gig at screenrant.com. Shout out to Screen Rant. If there are any readers of that site, it's pretty popular these days. But at the time, it was kind of an up-and-coming movie, TV, news type blog site. And yeah, I started out doing like just news type posts and eventually graduated to getting to do some reviews of some TV shows, which was a lot of fun. And I have a Rotten Tomatoes profile now.
Nice.
So, let's go.
Yeah, I got to get in the...
Are you a pretty critical person when it comes to shows? And when you're doing that, like what are you measuring? Like the quality,
Usually I'm measuring kind of what the project is trying to accomplish and how successful it is.
Okay.
So kind of judging it on where it's at. You know, if it's trying to be fun, if it's trying to be campy, you know, how well does it do that? Or if it's really trying to take itself seriously and be dramatic and have a good narrative structure, you know, how well does it do that?
Yeah. I feel like so often, and we've talked a little bit about this in the past, we try to like what TV show did you binge? You're embarrassed about, and I feel like there's a lot of shows that can like suck people in that are so corny, but it's just the premise is so gosh darn good.
Yeah,
so
that does happen. Yeah,
and speaking of a good premise, the focus today, besides meeting introducing Dan to everybody, is we want to talk about local politics. And Dan, now that you're here at the chamber, you have the opportunity to work with one of the best minds in our community when it comes to all things local politics related. Yeah. Tom Hofford, absolutely. But also Zach Solicki.
Yeah.
And so Zach's actually kind of flipping roles from host to guest today.
Yeah.
And I'm excited because I personally have very little knowledge when it comes to local politics. I'm learning a ton. And so it's always good to learn from Zach. And Zach, why do local politics matter? Like, why should I even care? Should I even care?
Absolutely. There is a famous quote by a former U.S. Speaker of the House,
Tip O'Neill.
And he has this famous quote that said, all politics is local. So when I got interested in politics initially, obviously the things that you kind of gravitate towards initially are like DC stuff. Like that's like NFL level. Like that's all the big politicians, all the big decisions are made. But you learn, you know, as you get into it, how much more things on a city, county, state level affect you as an individual more than on a federal level. So, you know, one of the great things about focusing on local issues is you have access to your elected officials at a much different level than you do on a federal level. Like I've interviewed in our other podcasts a number of local elected officials, and I've only, you know, had an opportunity to, you know, have one interview with one of our congressional delegates. And there's that level just from the access to those people that are making decisions. The other thing is a lot of the things that are being decided on a local level are focused specifically on your community. So when there's a big piece of legislation that's passed on a national level, there's little pieces that might affect you in like the workforce, for example, right? But when you're looking at the decisions that are being made that are going to affect you as a homeowner, as a business owner, as an employee, as just a regular citizen, those things are all being decided and kind of created on a much more localized level. And an example of that is, you know, we're looking at the Climate Action Plan, which has been a pretty big piece of legislation that the city's trying to pass. And with that, they're trying to implement about 213 different policies that would affect our climate directly right here in Salem. So they're hyper-focused on specific things that are going to impact us directly. So there's a lot of, like 99.9% of the stuff that's in there is good stuff. Like it's not going to have a major impact on people's day-to-day lives, but it's going to have a good impact on, you know, addressing climate concerns, which is important. But there's other things in there like, a ban on natural gas hookups on new development. Well, that's going to have a huge issue on housing affordability. So me as an individual, I don't own a house yet and I'm in the market looking for one, but housing prices are insane. Obviously, there's a lot of, you know, outside of the city scope that have an effect on housing affordability. But at the same time, there's a lot of other stuff from like a state level that has an impact on housing affordability.
So like me, when I think about what I should focus on, I generally let mass media, like the big news companies, tell me what to focus on. Isn't that the best approach? Like let them tell me what's important. Isn't that what I should do?
Oh, 100%. You know, let the experts on Facebook and Twitter tell us what's important. No, what's funny, and I think I've talked about this in the past before, and the thing with politics is at the end of the day, it's really just marketing, right? So the goal for people in politics is to get people fired up and passionate about certain topics that can galvanize people to one side of the aisle. And then you associate yourself with, you know, the two big parties, the Democrat, Republican Party. But those things, like what a lot of people don't understand on a state level, on a city level, county level, federal level, most policy, like 95% of policy is bipartisan. Like it passes unanimously. Right? Because it's good stuff. Most stuff like everyone agrees on.
But we don't hear about that.
You don't hear about that. Exactly. Yeah. Because that's not what's going to get people out and vote. Right? So right. They cling on to super emotional issues. Abortion, you know, that's the one always instantly comes to mind. You know, gay rights. So many of these things that people try to drive a wedge in between, you know, individuals. So you pick someone to root for. And it's a very tribalistic approach to politics. It's part of just the democratic, you know, not democratic in the terms of like, you know, little d democrat, like the system of government. But Yeah, you know, people, we're always going to clamor to things that are super, super emotional. And most of that stuff, I mean, it'll change from administration to administration. An example of that on the abortion issue, for example, is, you know, if you elect a Democrat, they're going to institute this policy called the new the Mexico City policy, which essentially allows the federal government, United States, to send money overseas to other governments to provide funding for abortions. When Republicans come into office, they get rid of that. It always goes back and forth. That's just one example. There's plenty of other things, but that's one that, you know, for one of these super highly emotional issues that are often changed. But yeah, what things affect us most is just general consumers. There's a lot of things outside of the political scope that are affected right now, like with inflation. Like, there's political policies that have been created issues of inflation, but there's also a lot of things that it's just a kind of a tertiary issue that there really isn't a control over.
So if you're 18 years old, 25 years old, 35 years old, and you're like, I've never really paid attention to local politics, but I kind of want to get started because I'm realizing that this is what is really impacting my community. I don't necessarily like the direction my community is headed. Where are some places you can get started?
Yeah, I mean, that again, it goes back to the access to local elected officials. Like, city councilors are, for the most part, super open to sitting down with their constituents and, you know, asking questions. You know, stay in touch with your local elected officials, follow them on social media and see, you know, oh, they're going to have a, you know, a city hall event where I can go and listen to them and ask questions. It's those things. Those are really good areas to get involved. Also looking at, you know, city council meetings. Those meetings happen every other Monday. So they're two times a month. You can learn so much from those, and you can understand the political dynamics. I mean, even if you have a pretty, you know, elementary understanding of political dynamics, you can pick up pretty quickly on where people sit and listening to the discussions that are being had. Talking with people, I think, super important. But I think the most important thing with that is talk to people that don't agree with you. Go into a conversation being open-minded and knowing that both Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservatives, everyone wants the same thing. We want a healthy, vibrant, safe community, but it's the way in which we get there where all the end fighting happens.
Yeah, I think that it's always amazing to me when somebody feels like, of the 7 billion people on the planet, like, they were the one to just be chosen to know everything.
Yeah.
Like, you have just been granted this just incredible perspective where you just get it. Mm-hmm. Nobody else does. Like, you have to realize, like, how stupid that sounds, stepping into a conversation and really be humble enough to recognize, like, you know, I got something to learn. I can learn a little something from everybody in this world. So I love that you bring that just perspective of humility. And something else that is an advantage for our chamber members is that you attend all of these and write incredible breakdowns of what's happening in all of these sessions. So I think that's an incredible resource that the chamber members have access to. Talk to me about the lens that you have. Like, what are the things that you're really listening for as you're attending these meetings and deciding what's going to fit into this summary?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing, you know, we're a business organization, so I'm focused, my lens is like strictly from a business perspective. So if there's policy that's going to be implemented, you know, it's pretty generally look at taxing issues, right? You know, you look at employment labor issues, you look at healthcare issues, look at transportation related issues. The real wonky stuff that you get into that you have, like, you discover, and this is something like once you really get into like looking at policy and trying to connect the dots on how things are going to affect the business community, you really get into like the administrative, like, rulemaking. So, you know, when a law is created, you know, at the state legislative level, there's an ability for the legislature to write words that are vague and broad and, you know, definitions that are vague and broad. And then it goes to, you know, that bill gets passed on to the executive branch and the governor, this same thing on the federal level, the governor, and same on a city level, then the governor has kind of, you know, the ability to implement it into law, right? And so when you look at the way in which administrative bodies, and they all have different rulemaking sessions that people can pay attention to, it's not entertaining, but if you're interested in it, you can make it entertaining. And then looking at the way in which those decisions are being made and how they're going to affect businesses. And, you know, one, I guess the most basic lens that I try to like wrap my mind around is, how is this going to affect the ability of a business owner to write a check to their employee? Mm-hmm. Like, that's kind of the easiest, I guess, for lack of a better term, like, dumbed down way that I approach looking at policy. Because in my eyes, that's what I think our organization's really fighting for, is the ability for business owners to write checks to their employees and create jobs. So if there's legislation for healthcare, for example, that's going to, you know, mandate some type of, you know, new fee that business owners are going to have to take on in order to pay for healthcare stuff for their employees. Well, that's going to affect profit margins. Profit margins, you know, and the ability to sell a good at a certain price, how much it costs for, you know, an employee. A lot of those things are taken into account. And as business owners, like, it's no secret, people that are in business are in the business of making money. It doesn't matter what you do, right? And so if there's policy that's created that's going to make it more expensive to hire people, then they're going to stop hiring people. And that goes against what we're fighting for. We want there to be as many, you know, living wage jobs as possible and above living wage jobs as possible. But when those policies are passed, it affects that ability for that, you know, that creation of new jobs to be made.
So you talk about the entertainment. I'm trying to think about, how do we make this more exciting? Like, do we do tailgating before city council sessions?
Like, we'll have to have a brainstorming session.
Drink tickets.
But yeah, it is really, you know, what you're talking about, Zach, is what I admire a lot about what you do. And I'm kind of learning, you know, the landscape and then about the chamber and about the business community and kind of the local political issues. But what I admire about what you do is, like we were saying earlier, most people, if you ask them if they care about local issues, they would say yes. But if you ask them, do they participate or follow it, they'd probably have to admit that they don't really. Yeah. And so how do we kind of make that translatable and relatable and relevant to them and kind of reach them where they are? And so I think a lot of what you're doing is really great in that way. So
I appreciate that. Yeah. I mean, again, I've gotten a lot of help from, you know, my other friends that are in politics, you know, the mentors that I've had, and trying to understand how to make things relatable. And, you know, again, it goes back to the marketing aspect. I didn't get a degree in marketing, but what I learned, we talked about this, I think, was it Tori? Yeah. I studied political science and history in college, but right when I got into actually working in politics, I learned how quickly that politics is all just marketing. So it's just finding ways to get, like, kind of stoke people's interest and emotion to say, like, this issue matters to you and you don't know it does,
but here's why you should care.
And here's why you should care. Yeah. Exactly. And it's so often where it takes a lot of effort, I think, early on to get into the mental space to understand and, you know, put enough effort into caring about these things. But the thing is if we don't think about it now, it's going to have a huge impact on our community later on. So.
So what are the topics right now that you would say are, here are some things that our business community or people that are interested in becoming part of the business community, whether it's, you know, starting a business, becoming a CEO, what are the things that we should be have sight of?
I mean, I think really it's just finding the different avenues to get informed and allowing yourself to be vulnerable to changing your mind on stuff. But at the end of the day, you know, when it comes to, like, policy that affects business, it's pretty black and white for the most part. I think there's other things outside of the scope of just being a business owner, but, you know, to share some insight on what's a local decision that's being discussed right now that a lot of people don't know and what the effect it's going to have on working families. A big issue that was discussed, I want to say this is back in December, city council is looking at passing a regulation that would require mandate a specific size for garbage cans for consumers. Mm. And the idea, their goal is, well, if you have a smaller garbage can, you can throw away less, so you're going to be more resourceful about the stuff that you buy. But if, you know, and they say, well, if you need an extra garbage can, you just got to pay for it and you can have two. It's like a 65 gallon or something is what they're going to cap it at. Well, that has a huge effect on working families. If you're a low income family and you have three kids, and you know, what comes with that is a lot of waste in the sense of, like, diapers, you know, garbage, whatever it is, like, it just happens. Well, now you're going to force them to pay an extra $50 a month to pay for another garbage can. So it's those things that happen on a city level that, again, people don't listen to hear us on the newspaper. But
yeah, I didn't hear about that one. That's crazy. Did they? What? Where are we at with that? What happened?
It was still in a discussion phase. I believe they'll take action on it sometime in the near future. But yeah, if those conversations aren't being had, what's going to happen is it's going to hit people's pocketbooks and they're going to be like, what the heck just happened? Like, why am I paying more now? And stuff like that, that people don't realize, like, that's why local politics matters. That's not going to happen at a federal level. That's your city council.
And those are the type of things that it would happen, and it would seem to a lot of people that it just happened overnight and this change just happened, but they didn't realize the mm-hmm. conversations that were going on and that they could have, you know, partook in that in some form.
Yeah, exactly. And I think our city staff, I honestly applaud them for the work that they do, and for the most part going out and getting insight from people and like asking questions and putting on seminars and, you know, whatnot, and communicating. And same with the city councilors, communicating with their constituents and saying, this is an issue that's coming up. There's some things though, but what often happens is city staff and councilors go and do that. No one gets involved. And then right when it's happening, there's a vote on it. Then everyone gets all up in arms like, well, I didn't know about this. It's like, well, city staff's been trying to reach out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think something that is hilarious about the garbage issue and trying to reduce waste, I want to get back to that, is what we should really do is eliminate these freaking yard signs. Like, you just can't print yard signs anymore. There's so much garbage that's happening. All these mailers that get sent out by the local politicians that didn't want to like reduce waste. How about this? Just don't print yard signs anymore.
Or how are they going to get elected? You need yard signs.
No, you shut up, Zach. There's other ways to communicate more effectively. Nobody is looking at your yard sign. I promise you that.
Well, it's actually mostly for the candidate than it is for voters. That's the thing. It's a way to build confidence inside for your own candidate. So you have, they're driving around their community.
It's almost like a gauge of...
It is. But
it's like a polling measure.
To a degree, it is. And it's, what's funny though, is more yard signs do not equate to more votes.
But it
gives the sense to the candidate. It builds momentum. Everybody. And it builds momentum for people that are involved and invested into it. It's, again, that goes back to the marketing aspect of it. Have the buzzing sound?
No, I heard like a radio frequency. That's never happened on this before. I wonder if they caught it on the recording.
Yeah, interesting.
Mm. Lancaster is trolling Lake Compton.
Oh, no way. Yeah, that's cool. Oh. Hopefully that comes through.
Could just be the voice in my head. I'm like 80% sure it's not. But yeah. So how have we seen an evolution in how candidates are marketing themselves and running campaigns? Because I feel like the local candidates are behind the times on how they market themselves and run their campaigns. Is this a conversation we should have, or should we exit?
No, let's have a conversation.
Yeah, I wonder if they mirror what they see in the national, at the national level too.
Well, it's funny. I actually had this conversation recently with somebody. It's always going to be different to a degree. And it kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about accessibility to your local elected officials, right? So when you're running for Congress, for example, you know, when I be in the House of Representatives, you have a huge, huge district that you have to represent. You're not going to go door to door for the most part as a candidate. Like, maybe you pay canvassers to go out and do that. On a local level, if you're in for city council, running for mayor, you're almost required in the sense to go out and hit doors and go door to door, knock on doors and call. The evolution has changed mostly, again, kind of in the targeted marketing realm. So the big evolution, you could say, really started with the Obama administration. They were the first it was very state of the art the way in which they approached their marketing efforts. They focused heavily on grassroots organizing, which from a nationwide election was incredible, like how successful they were. But they also were evolutionary in the sense of targeted marketing. So they're an example of that. And you can see like city really high level local races do it too. For the state legislature, you can even do it down in the city level. Because there's things called like geofencing, where you essentially you can target a specific area, like a building, right? So if there's an event going on down at the Salem Convention Center, you can pay for people's phones to essentially, quote unquote, be hacked in a way where if they leave a specific app open on their phone, then there's businesses that can target their specific cell phones and go in and essentially place ads in different areas within their phones that they see. And it's called geofencing. There's also like over the top, over the top advertising. And what that is essentially is you come up with you create a specific video that is talking about an issue that you know matters to a specific demographic of voters. In Salem, homelessness is obviously the number one issue. So you can target specific voters based off of the things that they find most interesting. So if they're, into watching, hunting shows and fishing shows, and they subscribe to the NRA magazine, you can deduce down from that they're going to be more conservative leaning, right? And again, I'm not trying to, make a general statement, but it's just like odds are most likely they're going to be.
That is exactly what a general statement is.
I know, but it's like, fine, I'm not saying everybody is that way, but you can, it's
most
just.
Most commonly
but that's
you'll see
how
this.
They would use the data.
Exactly, yeah. Right? So you can see what people subscribe to. And this is all this information is available to really anybody. Absolutely. And you can take that list, pull that list of who subscribed to X, Y, or Z things, and then you can target them with OTT, over the top marketing, and you can hit with specific videos and messaging on, hunting websites that this candidate supports, X, Y, or Z thing that is going to matter to them. And that happens on a state and city level, but that's super high, but super sophisticated stuff. Mm-hmm. Happens much more at a federal level, obviously, because there's a lot more at stake, what people think, at least for the most part.
I'm curious how TikTok's going to start being used in local campaigns, because per click, it is by far the least expensive out there right now, by far. So it's an older demographic. Like, since the last 2 years happened, a lot of the millennials have jumped on TikTok and are enjoying it. And the age is gradually getting older.
I just downloaded TikTok this weekend for the first time.
See, there you go.
Yeah.
Proof.
Yeah. Prime example. All my friends are sitting there saying, dude, you can find the funniest stuff. But what all my stuff is like informational, like geology and astronomy stuff.
Yeah. I'm going hard on TikTok right now. I post so much on there. I'm definitely trying to build a massive audience, but it's a process for sure. But a part of it is you're just seeing the migration of people.
You could say that could happen, but it also depends. You're not gonna, when you're running a camp, let's say for a federal position, right? Like you're running someone for the U.S. House of Representatives in Iowa, right? In a very rural area, you're probably not. Your demographic. Your voter base is going to be, 45 plus. Probably not going to go market on there. But if you're Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and you have a younger demographic and it's, Brooklyn and the Bronx and those areas, sure, get on TikTok because that's where your voters are.
But maybe, I don't know, I kind of wonder, and I don't know the answer, I'm just thinking out loud here, but I wonder, are people that are that demographic missing out because they have that perspective? My crew isn't there, as opposed to getting in there, developing trust, having some familiarity, understanding what these kids are talking about that are of voting age. I wonder if we missed the boat there. And I say we just
you could, but there's also the biggest voting block age-wise, that's another big thing that's taken into account when you're targeting people for voting. There's a couple metrics you look at. You can break it up by age. But one of the most important things, especially for a local race, this is what's really important. In an off-year election like this, so off-year means, midterm, so the middle of a presidential term, voting numbers are always going to be lower than what they are in a presidential year because there's a lot more money spent.
Those ad costs go up.
Oh, they go up incredibly. Yeah. But it also, you see a lot more tribalism happen during those years. So people get a lot more galvanized to a specific party because you're being force-fed information nonstop. Mm-hmm. During an off year, it's going to be interesting here in Oregon because we're in a midterm election, right? But we have a governor's race going on. There's going to be probably $30 to $40 million, if not more, of advertising that's going to be spent through the month of probably April to May because of the primary. not that 40 million is not going to be spent then, but between that and I'd say like September and October and November, there's going to be so much money spent. People are going to be you're going to be force fed political stuff nonstop. So the chances of you going out and voting in Oregon is going to be much higher than a normal off year election where there's not a governor's race. So that creates a different metric, but you also target how often the voting propensity of people. So how often someone is likely to vote. So you look at 4 of 4 voters, 3 of 4 voters, and maybe 2 of 4, depending on what cycle you're in.
What does that mean?
So if you voted 4 of the past 4 elections, you're a high propensity voter.
I gotcha. Okay.
If you're a 2 of 4, you vote 50% of the time, you may not be targeted as much.
Yeah.
But you also might be targeted if it's in an election year like this where we have a governor's race. So the down ballot effect, you hear this term a lot during presidential years. The down ballot effect essentially means if you are a Democrat and it's a presidential year, you're going to most likely vote for a Democrat. So when you're checking down all the other state representative, you probably don't know much about, you know, who your state representative is that's running for office, but they have a D next to their name, you're going to check that box.
So essentially, if they get you back in the game,
yep,
then there's a better chance that
yep.
you're going to go down the ticket. And
yep, and
even if you don't know a lot about the other races, yep. you're already there, you're already voting. Yep. So
you'll follow that R&D thing. And so that's something that Democrats have an advantage of in Oregon. There's, you know, from a numbers perspective, a lot more Democrats.
Okay.
But it also really matters too who you have at the top of the ballot. So, you know, and there's also a shift. So historically speaking, during midterm elections of a president's first year, the opposite party of who's in office tends to vote in higher numbers because you get a lot of people that are, you know, pissed off, right? So you'll have that effect where more, in this case, it could be more Republicans. You hear a lot lately that there's going to be a red wave. That means that Republicans are going to win in large numbers this year is what people are predicting. And you could see that happen in Virginia. You saw a, you know, really tight race in New Jersey. You saw a individual in New Jersey who was the Senate president. It was an established Democrat who's been in office for a long time. Lose to a guy who spent $130 on his campaign because he was a Republican truck driver and he won. That's insane.
What did he spend the money on?
No clue.
I want to know that.
$130.
Like I bought 13 pizzas.
Yeah. You can get some
buttons. I don't even know like what voice I just did, but go for a dance, right?
You could get some buttons for that price. Yeah.
What's it going right on a button?
I don't know, but I feel like you can get.
I feel like buttons are like 100x the return investment as a yard sign. So I support that. Anything that's not a yard sign, I support it.
Yard signs are important.
Probably got to get rid of these yard signs. We gotta stop. We gotta stop living in the past. Gosh darn it.
But there is often, you know, I've worked on a number of campaigns in the past and it's always a conversation like how important are yard signs? Again, it's really for the candidate and the team and people that are invested into the campaign.
Yeah. God bless them all.
But yeah, it's just going to be a really, really interesting year. I think, you know, we have city council races that are going on, some that people really should tune into and look into their candidates that are running. You know, we have, you know, we're at a point in our community where homelessness, I just looked at a poll earlier today where, you know, homelessness is the number one issue and it's not even close. Like the next thing is not even remotely close to how severe the homeless
issue is. And didn't even come up on the last city council meeting, right? It wasn't even like on the agenda.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing is like, it's talked about quite often, but I mean, there's a lot of this stuff too. You go and watch a city council meeting. They're pretty boring for the most part. Like it's you have to really get invested into it because they're talking about budget stuff and, you know, oh, we got, you know, this grant application, we're going to change the zoning or approve some kind of development in this area. You know, if you're working at a local small business and you're an employee and this stuff doesn't affect you, you're not going to get in tune and care about it. And that's fine. Like that happens, but there's a lot of other issues that get talked about that have a direct impact on you as a consumer, as a Salem resident, as a homeowner, as a home buyer. There's a bond measure that's going to be going out this year, $300 million proposed bond measure.
Per person?
Yeah, per person.
What is it? What's the bond measure?
So a bond measure, what is it, or like what is this specific
one? What is this specific one?
It's funding for in local infrastructure. It's broken down. I should have brought the sheet and I could, you know, go point by point. But the big thing is for fire, to provide more funding for fire equipment, which is, you know, super needed in our community right now. There's, you know, additional funding for local infrastructure. There's funding for affordable housing stuff for our homeless population. But what's insane is that's the number one issue in our community, far and away. But the amount of money, the percentage of the money that's going to be allocated to that is like a small percentage of what everything else is going to be spent on, like upgrading the library. And we just spent tens of millions of dollars, maybe not tens of millions, but definitely well over $1 million on, you know, upgrading our library, and they want to spend more money on it. And it's like, I think having a public library is super important.
Yeah,
absolutely. Mm-hmm. But homelessness is the number one issue. We should be spending $150 million on it.
Yeah.
But we also, it's really hard for a lot of people to say when you spend $150 million on it, if we don't have systems in place to say like, how can we measure the success from a, you know, from a specific metric.
All these issues are extremely complex.
Very.
So, but I think to your point, you just need to figure out what is the priority, what's being done. I think the other piece is, how are we measuring success? Because I feel like getting something passed is like the flag of honor people wave. But like, how successful was that program once it actually was passed? Yeah. What was the impact? It's something I think there should be more attention spent, focused there than I've seen in the past.
Well, and yeah. And again, that goes back to like the wonky side of stuff is people, you know, will really get out and vote when there's a specific issue that matters, or if there's a specific bill that people are curious and interested in. But no one goes back to look at how well it did. And that's important.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Zach, you mentioned predictions. Do you have any personal predictions politically? What's going to happen this year? Are you willing to go on record with any predictions right now of like what's going to happen or what's going to be kind of a big
issue? Yeah. I think so. I think we just met the record or over the record of the most Democrats in the House retiring. The last time there's over 30 people retiring from the Democratic caucus. There's a couple reasons for that, I think. I believe with the census just coming out and states across the nation did a lot of redistricting, that it could have placed a lot of these Democrats in vulnerable seats. Biden's numbers are down, and so him being the leader of the party might, you know, if people that are elected officials that are incumbents are like, I don't want to have to run this election, that could be an issue. So I think the Republicans will take back the House. I think the Republicans will take back the Senate. I think that's good either way. I'm always a proponent of having a balanced government. Whenever there is a Republican in office, I think it's really good and important to have a Democrat held legislature, vice versa.
Have those checks.
We got to really create the checks and balances. No party should have a mandate because no party speaks for the entire nation. I think on a statewide level, I think with Betsy Johnson being in the race as an independent, it's going to be really interesting to see how many votes are pulled away from generally Democrat voters, especially in the Portland metro area. And I think that it's either going to be a super, super close race and a Democrat wins, or I think a Republican could win. And if Betsy could very well win too, she has so much money right now. But if you're not in tune into like Oregon politics, a lot of people don't know who Betsy Johnson is. Mm-hmm. I've known Betsy since I was 8. I love that woman to death. But also, you know, most people don't know who she is. So yeah. I don't know. It's going to be a really interesting year to see what happens.
That was a good.
And polling, last point, all the polling that I've seen for legislative seats in Oregon, all the independents and non-affiliated voters, so people that are registered voters but don't pick a party. So there's a law that was passed a few years ago that when you get a driver's license or you renew your driver's license, you automatically turn into a registered voter. And most people don't realize that, and they don't pick a party, so they become non-affiliated voters. And so those numbers right now in districts, so they just, you know, they redrew all the House and Senate legislative districts here in the state of Oregon. And a lot of them went from, for example, one here right in Salem, House District 19, which Raquel Moore Green currently holds, has been about a +7 Republican district for a long time. went down to about a +4. So there's what that means is there's from a percentage standpoint, 4% or 7% more Republican voters for that voter base. After it was redrawn, it went to a +7 Democrat district. So that's a swing anywhere from 14 percentage points to 11 percentage points. But all the performance polling that's been done is showing that non-affiliated independent voters are breaking hard right. So to actually switch the seat to like a +8 Republican, if you're accounting for that change in the polling. So it's going to be a very interesting year.
Speaking of interesting, that was a great question, Dan. Good. Well, thank you. And now we have a chance to step into the hot seat, folks.
The hot seat.
So here's how the hot seat worked, Dan.
Okay.
You listen to the podcast. You actually know.
Yeah.
Which is awesome. Thank you, by the way. It's not just my dad listening. It's my dad and Dan that are listening to the podcast. Yep. But so we'll have a chance to ask a question. We will all answer all three of the questions and I'll get started. Unless you have one. Do you have one that you already picked out?
I did pick one out.
All right, go. You can get started.
So this, I think, kind of goes along with what we're talking about. So if you could solve one world problem, what would it be?
Go for it.
Mine. I'm a capitalist at heart, so I think getting as many people in the world out of abject poverty as quick as possible would be my priority. And I think what additional things that would affect, I think it would affect climate change because more people would care about it. I think food, starvation would obviously decrease. I think innovation, more additional innovation would happen because if you're in abject poverty, you're not thinking about how to create new solutions
you're
to problems.
You're thinking about how to survive.
You're thinking about how to survive. Yeah. So I think more innovation, like life-changing innovation could be created. So I think getting as many people in the world out of abject poverty as quick as possible would be what I would solve.
I like that. So what does that mean? It means that they have access to things. It means they actually have like money in their bank account.
They have resources. I think when people are outside of abject poverty, they have more agency over their decisions that they make.
Yeah.
And I think agency is one of the most important aspects to personal growth, growth of a community, growth of a family. So having access to resources, to money, and that number in terms of abject poverty on a worldwide level is pretty low. I'd say if you make under $3,000 a year or something, I think it's considered abject poverty. So
there's lots of people that have that. You're saying that it's low though? Maybe I misunderstand it.
On a nation, on an international level.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, so, you know, people in Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
That, you know, essentially live in villages, you know.
Yeah. Lots. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I think we kind of forget like poverty in America is very different compared to poverty in other countries where there's no programs that are there to help you out.
Statistically speaking, if you live at the poverty line or just below the poverty line in America, you're in the top like 3% in the world.
Yeah. It's pretty bizarre for sure. Having that lens on things. I feel like that's like lots of problems has to be solved to make that happen. But I love that answer. I'm trying to think of a different answer than that. Because I was thinking of like, do I pick water or food? If I had to pick one, like hunger or just no access to clean water. I think just make sure everybody had access to clean water would be like an incredible blessing, right? Just like starting there would be big. It's a pretty deep one, Dan. What are you going to go with?
Yeah, well, when I first even read this off and you started talking about poverty, you know, homelessness came to mind for me. I think a lot of people in this community and in a lot of cities on the West Coast are... it's a top of mind thing. So I was thinking about that. But as a media person, I also started thinking about mass communication and sort of the state of media around the world. And, you know, we have a real problem with a lack of objectivity and balance. Mm-hmm. And it causes so many other problems with a lot of the things that we're talking about when it gets to politics. So, you know, how do we solve that? I'm not sure, because we're so kind of fractured and siloed at this point. So it's like, it's almost, how do you go back to the way things were?
Yeah.
But to try to solve that, or at least educate people in a more holistic, comprehensive way about how they digest media, how they source things, you know, how to be informed, not just kind of where to go to confirm your bias that you already hold. And so a lot of people aren't willing to do that. But I think if you start the education younger, because the media landscape has changed so much with the dawn of social media, and I think we're just kind of catching up. But educating people younger on how, you know, how you're targeted, and I think we'll
help. Talking about, like how people are targeted. That's it's funny. I have so often I have my friends, you know, come to me and ask me, like, do you think we're close to a civil war? Like, how bad do you think it is? And I was a history man. I love history, and there's a common saying in, like, in, you know, when you study histories, you can never say something's unprecedented. So I try to use that very loosely. And so I tell people, I'm like, no, I mean, America's always been fragmented from a political perspective, but it's just so much more apparent, and it's grown so much more because of social media, because of this mass media communication. It's exacerbated in an issue.
Yeah, we'll transition to the next question. But the class we took at U of O in the J School was information gathering, where essentially the whole class is like having a critical lens on the data that you're consuming. And I'd love to see something like that at a much younger level. Because even just things like using the internet and knowing if somebody's like trying to get your information and phishing for it or trying to scam you. Like, I had to have this conversation with my son who's 8. Because somebody replied to one of his comments and was like, hey, you won this prize. And they had like this famous YouTuber's logo as their icon, but it's a completely different person. So like, just that people have to be made aware of these things and what to look for. Not just with like scammers, but people that are just spreading misinformation. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you know? How can you check your resources?
Yeah, well, and it's interesting too, because the generation, you know, our parents' generation that told us, don't believe everything you read or don't believe things on the internet, seems like they're the ones spreading a lot of misinformation on the internet.
That's hilarious.
So it's ironic in that way, but it's like, how do we kind of educate them as well? It's harder when you're kind of set in your ways and you're used to,
and you have a single source of information.
Right.
It's like, oh, that's what that news station was talking about today, Dad. All right. Yeah. All right, how about this? What is a mistake people often make about you? I can get started. Do you have one?
Yeah, it's funny we had this conversation earlier. I think people often think, because I'm very opinionated, that people think that I have to win every argument and I have to always be right. But I like to think that I'm super open-minded. I've changed my mind on plenty of issues, like plenty of issues, and super highly political and emotional issues I've changed my mind on. So I think that's one thing. I'm a contrarian by heart, so I always have to question things. So when I'm in a conversation with someone, I'm trying to dig deeper into like their reasoning and their logic behind it. And I'm very easily, I always tell Taylor, I'm the best friend to any salesperson, because you can get me to buy anything because I'm easily persuaded. So I think people often think that I'm closed-minded. Yeah, exactly. I think people often think that I'm closed-minded, and I'm not. I'm just super opinionated and ask a lot of questions.
I like it.
So what was the question?
What is a mistake people often make about you?
I get a lot of the times, I don't know if it's because I wear glasses or I'm in media, but a lot of people think I'm like a techie, like computer expert. IT guy. And I'm not. So please don't ask me questions about like how to fix things and
that's hilarious.
I'll tell you to turn it off, turn it back on.
Hit it a couple times.
Yeah. I mean, I'm okay with that stuff. And, you know, obviously I use a lot of it. And so I'm confident, but I'm not. No.
It's funny because I get it now. I never thought of it, but when you said it, it was like, oh my gosh.
A lot of people see me and they're like, oh, can you fix my... I'm like, I don't even know.
You definitely should have a side hustle as an IT guy, just like in movies. Like you're the extra IT guy in the background.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. All right. Thank you. Yeah. Good to know. I can just see like walking through the mall. Someone's like, hey, can you help me fix my phone?
Yep.
It's like, just save me out of the car.
I'm totally going to joke about that with you all the time now.
And I will not be able to help you, so you'll be very disappointed.
But the joke will get old very fast, and you won't get any help. So for me, I'm a very positive, optimistic person. So people sometimes think that I'm naive or that like I don't understand the challenges. But the reality is I do see the challenges. I've just learned through my history, I need to be better about expressing. Like, I understand like these things are going to be very hard, but I also think we can overcome these and work past it. So I've had to kind of learn how to
like
navigate those conversations a little differently, because I never want someone to feel like I'm discrediting something that's hard for them.
Oh, that's, I like that. What I always appreciate about you is whenever you're always so open to like bring up hard subjects with me on things that I might be naive to. And you always do it in such a very teacherly way. And I know if I'm ever struggling through something, you're always one of the first people, how can I help you? And I love that about you.
I think part of my approach also is just like, I realize like maybe I'm actually wrong. So like, I don't want to approach this in a way where I'm certain that I'm right, but I do want to like, let's have a conversation and kind of share some things that I've learned. And then, yeah. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
And most people come into conversations believing wholeheartedly they're 100% right.
About everything.
Yep.
About everything. Madness.
Goes back to my point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of times I do think I'm 100% right. And there's some things I will stick by, like LeBron James being the greatest basketball player of all time.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Next question.
Like, we're not getting into it. Both you guys look at each other. Don't do it.
We're
don't
not
do
doing
it.
That tangent right now.
Who had the most influence on you growing up?
I'll go first. It definitely was my dad. My mom passed away when I was really young, and so he raised my brother and I. And even though I'm sure he didn't feel like he was having an influence on me because I didn't want to listen to anything he had to say at all, because I felt like I was right about everything. Like, I think just going through high school, we kind of go through those moments. But yeah, he definitely was.
No, I think my dad was too. Our personalities are very similar, and I think I just kind of absorbed a lot of him and emulated him in a lot of ways, and obviously always looked up to him too. And so, yeah, I would say the same. I was a only child, basically. So yeah, it was just my parents and me and friends. So
nice. I don't mean to be cliche, and I'm going to try to do this without, you know, shedding a tear, but definitely my dad was definitely the biggest impact in my life. It was really hard losing him back in November, but he was an individual who literally got the crappy end of the stick of life. He was born with congenital heart disease. He shouldn't have lived. I mean, when he died, he was the oldest person in the United States with this heart disease. His sister died when he was young. His brother died when he was young. And my dad was really close with both of them. Lost his best friend right in front of him. So you watch his best friend die. And he was always been the most giving person I knew. Got involved with a number of nonprofits in the community. He dedicated his entire life in the field of law to helping women in domestic violence cases and helping win custody for women and their children. So, I mean, just an individual who was the most giving person in the world with like everything going against him. So he just taught me so much by his actions.
Awesome. Well, appreciate you all. I wish I could have met your dad, man.
He's a good guy. He's a good man.
Yeah.
That's the episode, Save Emerging Leader Workshop. Salem Emerging Leader Workshop is like three different podcast names I've done in the past combined into one. But thank you for joining us, the Salem Emerging Leader Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the newsletter. We will leave a link in the show notes. We have things coming, like a website of our own, like a calendar of events, so you can go to know all of the Salem Emerging Leader programming. And now that we have Dan on board, we are really excited to have his skill set and his ability to tell stories. I can't wait to see what he has to this team.
I think another really awesome aspect about having Dan on, especially this is exclusive to emerging leaders. If you ever have issues, like tech issues, Dan's your guy to go to.
Oh, no. Here it goes. I shouldn't have said anything.
You got to be careful what you say around Zach.
Yeah.
I make jokes about a lot of things.
I appreciate you. You just got done listening to the Salem Emerging Leader Podcast, and we appreciate it. If you look in the show notes, you will find a link. If you click on that link, you'll be able to subscribe to the Salem Emerging Leader newsletter. We want you to be in touch with all the incredible things that are happening in this city because of people like you. We appreciate you. I hope you have a good day.